so begins.
There is a hole in your mind.
What do you want?
No one here is exactly what he appears.
Nothing's the same anymore.
Commander Sinclair is being reassigned.
Why don't you eliminate the entire non-holy race?
I see a great hand reaching out of the stars.
Who are you?
President Clark has signed a decree today declaring
martial
law.
These orders have forced us to declare independence.
Weapons
and supplies. That's why people get off their encounter-suited butts and do something.
You are the one who watched.
To Zahadu, who will die.
Why are you here? Do you have anything worth living for?
Think of my beautiful city of flames.
Giants in the playground.
Get the hell out of our galaxy!
We are here to place President Clark under arrest.
Hello and welcome to Chats, the television podcast, Season 6, Chat Salon 5. My name is Alan, and when every day is a risk, cards and dice are no longer appealing to him. It's Magellan!
Hey!
Magellan from Chats Pod.
I still love cards and dice.
Yeah, but you like magic cards.
Huh? Like Magic the Gathering cards?
Yeah, no, magic, like doing magic tricks with cards.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Do you want to get into Magic the Gathering, pal?
I've thought about it. People don't know. I don't think I've mentioned this, but I started a part-time job at a board game store.
Hell yeah.
Just on Saturday mornings, they do, like, families can come in and do, like, free play. So I've been doing that. Sorry. Return of the cough. You won't hear any more coughs today. So I've been doing, like, that family free play block, and after that, they have Pokemon card game tournament from 2 to 4, and then from 4 to 6, they have a Magic tournament every Saturday. And so every week I'm like, do I want to get into trading card games right now? And I think back to, like, all the Yu-Gi-Oh cards I had, and I was like, that was pretty cool to have, but I could only ever really play with my siblings and stuff. Some of the other guys at the store were talking about Yu-Gi-Oh! Actually, and they were saying that, like, one of them watched a video where someone was saying that there are some Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards that have, like, more than 1,000 words on them.
Oh, hell yeah.
And that the font size is, like, size 4 font or something.
That's the only way I know how to read things, is
like
size 4
font. It gets kind of sillily complex.
Yeah, just all
so
words.
I've always wondered how Magic compares to Yu-Gi-Oh! In that sense.
Magic, from what I've seen, because I have a friend on Instagram who posts a lot of Magic the Gathering memes, and I always look at them and I'm like, that's cute. I'm glad you're having fun. They usually do them in, like, 2 sentences. It's just like they don't put the lore, or they put the lore in, like, a single sentence quote at the bottom, but then, like, the actual card effect is, like, a couple sentences. They keep that light. Magic seems pretty easy to understand on a basic level, but, you know, that I don't have the income right now to, like, devote to a card game. I think there are, like, online ways to play Magic that end up being a little bit cheaper. You're still buying decks, but, like, you don't, and obviously you don't have to keep the space for them, but some people like that. And then,
yeah, I would want to have them.
Yeah, just to have the cards.
Yeah.
When I was visiting you in New York, though, and we were at a board game store, we watched some people setting up for a Warhammer 40K game behind us, and that, like, completely captured my attention. I was like, I really, really want to get into 40K, and I looked into it, and I was like, oh, this is one of, like, top 5 most expensive nerd hobbies out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm
and
not
so time-consuming. Like, you're, like, painting your figurines and stuff.
Yeah, and a friend of mine actually is, like, super into that stuff and was like, you don't have to do, like, the painting. And I was like, no, but that's the only thing I want to do. Like, I might not even want to learn to play it. Like, if a perfect world is I could read the lore, obviously, because I love lore, and then paint other people's units, and then they can go play Warhammer with those. And I'll just paint all units, and I'll be, like, the crafter. That'll be my thing. But, Magellan, I am here to craft a television podcast with you.
Let's do it.
This week, we watched 2 more episodes of Babylon 5. We watched Season 5, Episode 15, Darkness Ascending. And we also watched Season 5, Episode 16, And All My Dreams Torn Asunder. First, we're going to discuss Darkness Ascending, which was written by J. Michael Straczynski. It was directed by Janet Greig. It aired June 3rd, 1998, and it takes place from July 23rd to the 30th of 2262. John, what happened in Darkness Ascending?
In this episode, Lanier risks his life to uncover the proof needed to implicate the Centauri in the attacks on shipping lines. Sorry, I'm sitting far away. Lise arrives on the station and confronts Garibaldi about his relapse. Alan, oh, what do you think of Darkness Ascending?
This sort of felt like another like section. This whole like chunk of episodes feels like they're all connected really well. Mm-hmm. And this felt like a part two or like a part three to the last couple. So like all of the Lanier stuff was just like, yeah, you already know Montoya, like you already know what he's got going on. We're just gonna get right into like the reason he's actually here. And then the Garibaldi stuff was like, and now you're watching something that you already known about coming to a head. And so like I think overall the episode is interesting, but it struggles a little bit on its own because it's mostly like building and setting up things. But yeah, I still think overall there's like some great moments in this one. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think what this episode suffers from is that it can't really create new consequences because we already sort of know what is at stake and what's going to happen by the end of the episode. Like this episode doesn't make the Centauri stuff any worse, and it just sort of moves along to the point that we knew was going to happen, where now everybody knows that there's proof that the Centauri are attacking the shipping lanes. But that's something that we knew we were going to get to regardless, right? Yeah, I think what this episode suffers from is that it can't really create any sort of new consequences. It takes the Centauri stuff to the point where we knew there was going to be some kind of proof. We get to the proof. The Garibaldi stuff, we know that it's going to continue to cause problems, and it does. So we're not really taken by surprise in this episode, but I do think that there are some characterful scenes that happen between different members of the cast that make it a fun watch, even if there's nothing like particularly revelatory happening in Darkness Ascending.
Yeah. We're just watching Darkness Ascend. We're watching the beginning of like a lot of catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Garibaldi actually starts this episode waking up on a completely destroyed Babylon 5. And when he sees the tipped over Zocalo sign, which in hindsight is a little bit of like beating us overhead with the symbolism, is like the bar is what he sees like toppled over in his dream.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in that moment, I'm turning into Barney from The Simpsons, and I'm like, ah, shit, dude, they destroyed the bar, Homer. Like, oh, no.
You just wanted an excuse to do that.
You're right. You're not wrong at all.
That's a great one, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, shit, dude.
Doesn't say shit or dude.
he's constantly saying, ah, shit, dude, what the fuck, dude?
He does not say that.
It's a classic Barney Rubble line. Gumble? Gumble. Barney Rubble's from the Flintstones. I love that the enemy in his dreams is himself. Because of course it is. Because shut up. It's a dream. Right? All right, guys?
Right. Yeah.
It feels like season 5 Babylon 5 dreams are just like, yeah, you know they're messed up. We wanted to film a fun thing, okay? But the interesting part of his dream is that he wakes up into another dream where Lita is like, hey, I'm not hiding the Vorlon stuff in me anymore. Her eyes are completely covered in white. They're just fully white. And she goes, also, you're not going to remember this. You're going to think it's a dream. And he goes, what? And then he wakes up again. And it's the classic, like, now he thinks this one is a dream because it's Lise coming back. Like, aren't you going to say hi? And he's like, huh? And that's our cold open. Is that Lita stuff real? Hello?
Great question. I'm going to say yes.
Right? I'm so scared.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes because it makes Lita so much scarier and more interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost as scary as them like dropping the Telepath logo in the theme song and you don't even notice it unless you're watching it, but that's not exactly subtle, it's just like I didn't look at the screen. Mm-hmm. Him and Lise are chatting for a bit, talking about old times and why he doesn't talk to her. They have some chemistry, I think, just like by sheer will of like seeing them together a lot. I've kind of come to like them together, but it's like, the actress who plays Lise is like okay, and Jerry
Doyle.
Yeah,
that was really my negative of this whole Lise plot is that it kind of isn't written great, and then she just feels really wooden throughout the whole thing.
It's more to me that It's more to me that Zach Allen has so much more past with, and I don't just mean to be the queer person on the podcast, but like the Garibaldi Zach chemistry feels a lot more lived in and like understood by everyone involved than the Lise Garibaldi chemistry.
Yeah, that's true. That's
you know, it's just like they understand each other's faults. Whereas with him, it's just like, we don't know that much about Lise. We don't know what her faults are or what she found attractive about him. We just know that he left her and like gave her a key because he was like, I'll be back. Like she's the neglected wife is her entire character.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't help with that. But then also, yeah, it's just like the performance is good, not great. Yeah. Lanier calls Delenn and in just a very dark moment, it's just like, hey, everyone's dead. Like, people are just dying out here. The Mercury warships are, like, all gone, and, like, a lot of people are dying, and we can't not figure out the Centauri stuff. So that's now set into motion. Lita is talking to Jakar, or she says she's going to call Jakar. She calls him. She actually speaks to him later. But this is her being asking for more telepaths if she can put more telepaths on different ships.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just love that everyone is, the person that she's speaking to is like, if they're not with PsyCorps, then we can't pay their insurance. Like, fuck. Like, insurance problems plague even telepaths on Babylon, on the show Babylon 5. We get a brief character moment. This is just a lot of, like, short scenes. We get a good character moment of Viren Londo. And also, Majon, feel free to cut me off if you want to say something about one of these scenes. But
yeah, sorry. Wait, can we backtrack?
Yeah, certainly.
Oh, yeah. Just with the Lita, the insurance scene, it reminded me that this actually isn't the first time that insurance has been, like, frustrating for Lita.
Right, right.
Because she tried to work for somebody before and insurance was an issue, which is why she, like, sold her body to work for PsyCorps again.
Right. It's, yeah, I think just economic and, like, financial trouble in general is what is one of, like, the most relatable things about Lita's storyline.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it just keeps coming back in interesting ways.
Can we just talk about all of Lita's storyline here?
Sure, yeah. It's only this and, like, the other scene, so yeah, why not?
Yeah, so she goes to talk to Jakar. I found this really amusing.
Yeah.
Because she essentially, she tries to go through the corporate angle. It doesn't work. And what she's trying to accomplish is she wants to find a homeworld for telepaths.
Yeah.
And then she goes through Jakar and she says, hey, remember that deal from, like, back in, I don't even remember when that was.
I think it was, like, seriously season, if, like, the first episode of the show?
Oh, yeah. Was it in the pilot movie?
I don't know if it was. No, because wasn't she not in the movie? Oh, no, she was.
She was, and then she wasn't. And then she was gone for a while.
It was either that or Midnight in the Firing Line then.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like as early as
I think it seriously was in
The Gathering.
The Gathering, yeah.
Wow.
That's cool, right?
That's very cool. And they acknowledge this because she's like, we haven't, like, because the great chemistry of Jakar is that he just works with everyone. And like, he's like, yeah, we don't talk. Like, you've been on the ship and we, like, never hang out with each other. Why don't we do that? And he's like, yeah, I guess, hold on, we should probably talk more. And then remembering that they totally did back in the day, like a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So she's like, remember that deal? Yeah, I'll give you some of my genetic material in exchange for you helping me, like giving me a bunch of money and helping me find a planet. And my favorite part of this is like horny Jakar just comes out of nowhere. You forget very easily that he is super, super lecherous.
Yeah.
Which is a little gross. It's kind of a knock against Jakar. But also, Andreas Katsoulis plays it so, it's so funny the way he plays it. Because he's like, yeah, the deal was like you'd give us some genetic material. And then he whispers and he's like, or, you know, directly mating with one of us. Lita's like, what? What was that? Oh, nothing. And then she's like, I want to take you up on that deal. And he's like, which part of it? Is it the part where we fuck? Because that's what I want to do.
He's allowed to be horny. I mean, we've it's funny because we have, like, literally been like, we don't want horny Jakar, but I think Jakar putting his eye in on, like, Sheridan.
No, that's different.
It's completely different.
Completely different. That's, like, creepy. But, like, you know, a little like raunchy. I'm into it.
Yeah, he's allowed to reflect his age, you know. I think the other line that's great there is when they're talking about the breeding, and then she's like, "Yeah, I'll do it." And I think she, yeah, this I believe this is her saying this, but he's like, "What do you want for it? Like, what do you want for it to be able to like breed with the Narn?" And she's like, "We need a lot of money. We need like a ton of money because you're like basically founding a new colony. We need a ton of starships. We need like, you know, military and privacy." And he's like, why privacy? And she says, "This is about as internal of an affair as I can think of." And I'm like, "Ugh, gross, yucky, no. Again, sex in Babylon 5 mixed like oil and water. They just feel like they do not fit
well, and
together.
Then the grossest part, not gross, but like the most extreme example of that is when she's leaving. And earlier in the scene, Jakar is like, "We never figured out what your pleasure threshold is."
Oh, my God.
And then Lita's leaving, and she's like, "By the way, Jakar, I recently found out that I don't have a pleasure threshold."
Yeah.
"Because Byron loved me up real good.
Real, real good. He made he did nasty things to me.
It was infinite loving what we had."
Ugh. Barf.
So think about that, big boy. Wink.
Wink. Walks out of the door.
It's like cartoon. Like she's... It was kind of a weird flip because she had not been leaning into the sultry, seductive part of it at all. And then she catches on, like, right as she's leaving, "Oh, Jakar's really wanting to bone down with me. Maybe I can use that to my advantage." As she has one foot out in the door, she has that realization.
By the way. Yeah, it's yeah. I do actually like Lita acknowledging herself as like a sexual human and being able to leverage that in like what she really wants, which is this like homeworld for the telepaths.
Yeah, I like that too. It was just funny, the pacing of the scene.
Definitely. It's just like, "Oh, by the way, one more line." Speaking of scenes that recall moments from season one, Garibaldi decides to take Lise tonight to a fancy restaurant, which careful viewers may remember because Garibaldi mentions that this is where Sinclair invited him and Ivanova when he got engaged to a long time ago flame Catherine Sakai.
Oh my what? God, that was so funny. He's like, "Yeah, last time I had drinks here, ate here, or whatever, it was season one, and we had a whole cast of side characters that don't exist anymore.
There was a lot of women that don't matter anymore."
That line, it was so funny when he said, "Zakai disappeared like a year ago," or something.
Fuck if I know where she went.
She's just gone. She died. If you were looking for Catherine Sakai,
resolution.
Yeah, she's dead.
She disappeared.
As soon as Sinclair learned that he was in Tilza and he needed to go do his thing, he was like, "Bye,
bye." She's left to wander above Epsilon 6 or whatever for eternity.
Yeah.
Never mind. He takes her to that restaurant, and then this is where I was like, sometimes the Garibaldi alcoholism plot is like really goofy. At first, I was annoyed that the waiter was giving him shit for wanting to order coffee at dinner. Mm-hmm. I was like, "What the heck? This is so unrealistic." Because he promises Lise that he won't have a single drink while she's there. She's like, "You don't have control of yourself," because she finds his booze in the previous scene.
Yeah, she finds his booze.
And he's like, "I'm totally in control of it. I'm the one making my own destruction." You know, he gets into this later, but he's like, I control it. It's not a problem. And she's like, "If it's not a problem, then you can't drink at all. You have to go complete sober while I'm here." And he's like, "Fine, sounds good." Takes her dinner. She's like, "Oh, I'll have some wine. Make sure it's red." Which, dumb. But that's not how you order wine. You should just get the wine you want, because they tell you what kind of wine it is.
Yeah.
But they're like, "And anything for you to drink?" And he's like, "Yeah, just coffee." And he's like, "Yeah, for sure, for dessert. But like, what about to drink?" And he's like, "Yeah, coffee." And the guy's like, "Do you know how drinking works?" Like, "Unfortunately, I do. Get me some fucking coffee." What I didn't realize was that later the waiter and Garibaldi were sending signals that like, "Yep, you have my stash of booze. When I get up to leave and ask for this thing, you are going to give me my flask, and then I'm going to give back to you, and we're going to have a little secret drinky situation."
No, it wasn't quite that coordinated.
Oh, is it just like, "Hey, thanks for that whole thing back there?"
No, the waiter really was like an asshole.
Perfect.
Then Garibaldi took his coffee outside, took his flask out, and put booze in it, and the waiter came up and was like, "Oh, you wanted the coffee. I gotcha. Okay.
So it wasn't like a brilliant moment of subtlety. It was a really weird waiter.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Because it's just like a fancy restaurant. He's a jerk waiter.
Yeah.
That's all it was. I really wanted, I guess part of what kind of bugs me about the Lise plot here is I just wanted her reaction to his alcoholism to be more significant. Like, it's weird to me that she's the first character who discovers it.
Right, because yeah. Because
she's supposed to be, like, everything to him, you know?
Yeah.
He is like, I'm changing my whole ways. Like, I don't know. Just the way it felt at the end of season 4 was like, Garibaldi's finally with her and has found something that matters to him. That he can, like, I don't know, that he can live with, and he can leave behind the sort of weird soldier complex that he's had for forever. And so for her to show up and for him to be like, why are you here? Leave me alone. And then she's like, you don't return my calls, even though we, like, are in love forever and ever. I wanted her reaction to be more grounded and real, and like for her to say to him, listen, dude, you drinking was like a big part of what ruined us before. Yeah.
It's like one of the main reasons. It's what got you stuck on Babylon 5 with no chance to leave too. Like, there's a lot of reasons that your alcohol has, like, led to where your life is right now. Alcoholism, rather.
So I don't know. And then they start to talk at dinner about how she's like, well, you're going to come back to Mars and you're going to leave Babylon 5. And he's like, oh, the steak looks really nice tonight or whatever. He's like, oh, they make a fake steak out of something.
Uh-huh.
And she gets mad. Oh, you didn't tell him yet. And again, that's a moment where, like, you could have opted for this, like, really genuine conversation between the two of them. And instead, Lisa's written as like, ugh, get me a glass of wine.
Yeah. Like, this might be a spicy take, but I want to see what you think about it.
Spice it up.
Ordering alcohol at dinner with an alcoholic, like a recovering alcoholic, probably a bad move.
Yeah, that's the one thing that makes this more interesting. I didn't even catch it when I was watching the scene. But the fact that she orders alcohol is clearly a targeted, like, fuck you jab at Garibaldi.
Or just like a, like, if you really think you can control yourself, then you should be okay, like, seeing me being able to do it.
Yeah.
And then him just having the flask is like, oh, he's not controlling it. He's in fact doing the opposite. He's letting it control him.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the Lee stuff, ultimately, this is like the plot that was most affected by the weird way that this season has come about, is it really did feel like he had a conclusion with her. We saw them sit in bed together. They were like, okay. And now they're suddenly not okay, as if we undid a season's worth of development. Like, it just feels, their relationship specifically feels weird.
I think it's, you know, it's totally normal for them to have problems. And I think it makes sense for Garibaldi's character for, like, the way that the Bester stuff is affecting him is that he's going to return to drinking and all that.
Yeah.
It bugs me that the way that their sort of disagreement manifests is like a very kind of stock sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because we're saying, they're supposed to have such a rich history with each other. They're supposed to have gone through these problems before, and I want for them to acknowledge, like, the cycle that they're in, I guess.
Right. So that ends up making this plotline feel a little bit strange and off, but we know it to progress. Since we watched the two episodes, that's going places. And where does the Lise plot, like, conclude? Does she just, like, leave again? Oh, yes. Once we realize that, like, shit is about to go down, she is back at his quarters and it's like, I planned us a nice evening. We're gonna watch Netflix. We're gonna finish Game of Thrones, and then we're gonna, like, jerk off separately, and it'll be really cute. And then he's like, you need to go. And he's like, oh man, something bad happens every time I go to that stupid restaurant. And any day now, we're going to be at war with the Centauri. You gotta go. That's how the episode actually ends. So he basically kicks Lisa off of Babylon 5, being like, there's no more plot or necessity for you. You gotta get out of here. Zach will take over for making me feel bad. But yeah, it's okay. Meanwhile, Lanier is leaving his post to go do that spy mission. He's assigned to spy on the Centauri, which causes some friction between Sheridan and Delenn. I was fascinated by this scene where Sheridan is like getting really angry. He thinks he's about to get really angry at Delenn for making this order to send Lanier out. He like gets ready to start shouting, and then she's like, no, dude, you're totally right. That was very irresponsible of me to set Lanier out on that mission. He's like, hold on. No, Delenn, he says, I was working up a good mad all day. Don't undercut this. Like,
yeah.
I've totally been that person before, too, where you're like, oh, my God, I'm going to have such a fire argument. She's never going to be able to stop. And then she's like, I'm sorry. And you're like, damn it.
But I'm also, wrong. Like, she doesn't actually admit that she was wrong because she's like, you're
no, she's
right.
She's like, it was bad.
She's like, you're right, but also
I'm right.
More right than you.
Yeah, she flips that argument because she's like, actually, you're right, it's irresponsible, but why, like, that's why I did it, like, or whatever. You know, she just kind of, like, it completely flips the argument on him and is like, why didn't you send him? Because you can't send him.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, this really bugged me, their whole, because it just... Because Delenn's not apologizing.
Right.
She's not being honest. She, like, has a crush on Lanier.
Right.
And she thinks that her judgment is totally, totally crystal clear and that she's making decisions for the right reason. And it's like there's no partnership here. And Sheridan is doing the same thing. Like, I thought for sure Delenn was going to bring up... I thought for sure she was like, yeah, you're right that I shouldn't have, like, sent my friend out there. But then I'm right that you shouldn't have brought in your ex-wife to be the captain of Babylon 5.
Why does nobody talk about Lockley? When she's not on screen, she literally doesn't exist on the show. She is his ex-wife.
Yeah.
It's so bonkers. But she doesn't mention that. Instead, she's just like... did you not assign Lanier because he's friends with me? Because I assigned him and I know what I'm doing and you're wrong. And he's like, okay. And it just, it's this very like depowering moment for Sheridan that.
But it's also so, what's so frustrating about it is like, really? There are no other Rangers who could do it?
He's the most experienced.
No, he's not though. But he's like maybe one of the most experienced dudes, but as a Ranger, he's not that experienced.
Well, she also trusts him the most.
Yeah, but that trust isn't something that she can necessarily like objectively rely upon.
True. True, true, true.
I just don't think that she's like as absolutely in the right as she's presenting herself, and that's really frustrating to me.
The part of this plot that I enjoyed a lot more, because again, Sheridan Delenn, just relationship problems always doesn't feel right, but Lanier's...
They're arguments were like too real. I was getting really stressed out.
Yeah. Lanier, meanwhile, is like busy solving a really interesting space mystery where he's just like, I'm gonna like let myself drift for a while and I'm gonna steal this ship from the White Star and I'm gonna like go into hyperspace and find this like Brakiri ship being attacked, and I'm gonna like latch on to whatever leaves hyperspace and we'll see what it is. And he does that and he realizes that it's a Centauri ship, and he's like, ooh, he gets enough air dust to get out of there and sees a whole Centauri base that this is where they were going. And he's like, oh, I figured it out. The Centauri are responsible for these little attacks that, like, I'll give them credit for. They've kind of been, like, subtly mentioning throughout the season. They haven't made a big deal about, like, there are attacks. They are this. It's like, yeah, sometimes they would just be talking and be like, what's the deal? And they're like, oh, some attacks on, like, some ships happened. It's fine. And we now know where they're all coming from. So it felt like a really, like, rewarding moment, even though we expected it for so long.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The problem, though, is that, like, Lanier doesn't get back to people for a while, so Delenn legitimately suspects that he died. And we kind of get a little bit of Delenn, like, getting ready to cope with that. Right before he's like, no, actually, Linear's fine. He's going back to Babylon 5. But I kind of liked this moment where she has to be like, oh shit, I kept sending him out to do dangerous missions and now he died for me. Like, her almost having to reckon with that, but then not really, because they don't have time for this.
Yeah.
Also, check another box for Delenn waking up in the middle of the night, being like, Linear might be dead, and Sheridan's like, it's four in the morning!
Yeah.
Please let me sleep once!
I did appreciate at the end of that scene where, like, it could have been like, oof, this is tense, and there, Sheridan's trying to apologize, but, like, it's still tense. But then Delenn reaches for his hand. That was nice. I was like, oh, okay.
Right. I did forget to mention, though, the conclusion to the Jakar and Leeta stuff was just he eventually, like, thinks about the whole plan.
Oh, that's right.
This moment I have mixed feelings about. That's why I erased it. Same. But he's like, okay, we'll go through with the whole telepath breeding thing on the condition that we get to use telepaths to listen in on ambassadors. Sound good? Seems fine, right? She's like, actually, no. Actually, I have morals, and that seems like a bad idea. And he's like,
that was a test, Leeta.
I just tuned and examined the fuck out of you, Leeta, and you were supposed to say no, and now because of that, I say yes. And it's like,
yeah, that was
this is such a Jakar thing, though. It totally works for him to be like, I was just playing with you.
Yeah.
But it just felt like nothing, because I'm like, okay, so the result is that, yes, the Narn are going to work with the telepaths, which is great. Linear's
so
back
is that
on the ship.
It? Are we done with Leeta? Like, did we figure it out?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, we still either see the homeworld thing happen or we see this go wrong in a different way.
Okay.
Especially because, well, we know now that Jakar is not going to be, like, available to hit her up because all communications with Babylon 5 are blocked from Centauri Prime.
True.
Goal. Delenn, now realizing that the Centauri are responsible for this stuff, is preparing for tragedy. Beautiful, beautiful scene. Again, Delenn, often the source of some of the most emotionally effective scenes, because Mira Furlan is a fucking incredible actress. She finds Londo, and she starts crying. And he's like, what's going on? Why are you crying? And she gives him a big hug. And you don't see a lot of hugging on Babylon 5, but when you do, it matters. I love a good hugging scene. And she's like, we probably aren't going to ever do this again. I might never get to, like, be nice to you. And he's like, and it's not only, like, the sadness of her realizing that, it's the sadness of Londo not realizing that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I've had, like, older folks be talked to. Like, the last time I went to Syria, I was, I think, 13 years old. And I remember my grandparents saying bye and, like, hugging me and being like, yep. Probably not going to get another one of these. And they didn't.
Damn.
And they knew it. And I was just like, that's weird. Like, what are you guys talking about? Like,
oh, God.
You know? And it's not to say that one of these characters is going to die at some point, but it definitely recalled that moment of, like, one of you knows what's going on. And so the rest of this episode is just building up to the anxiety that explodes in the next episode where Londo is desperately trying to be like, what the fuck are people worrying about? What did I do?
Because he's told by the captain of the football team that that's what that guy's jawline makes me think of. He's told, like, hey, Londo, they're going to try to frame us, so watch out. And Londo's like, no, they're not.
That would be stupid.
Everything's fine right now.
This moment's so scary to me too, because he's then talking to Veer, and Veer's like, yeah, so they're doing a meeting? Yeah, they're doing a meeting and you're not invited. And then they see Franklin and Garibaldi talking to each other and kind of, like, looking over at Londo like, no, not him though. And then they leave, and you're left with Londo and Veer being like, what did we fucking do? Like, what's the...
Yeah.
It's so like sad and scary, and, you know, I can feel that moment. Like it's happening into my own family. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not even just performances. It's like, you know, acting is reacting that whole thing, because it's just other people getting ready for business as usual. And these two are just like, did we start something? Mm-hmm. Are we mad? Mm-hmm. Should we go there? And then, we end on Garibaldi telling Lise. This felt like a very, like, you guys had to get a good line to end the episode on, where he's like, tomorrow we could be at war with Centauri Prime.
Bum, bum, bum.
Exactly. Any stray notes on this one, Magellan?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. Yeah.
Fabulous. Yeah. It's it's a pretty intense episode that's setting up what I think is going to be some scary dominoes.
Oh yeah.
Which, if you're in a quiet room, or if you're playing dominoes next to your sleeping dad, then aren't all dominoes scary dominoes?
Hmm.
You just imagine. That joke is way funnier in my head, I promise you.
I liked it.
Thank you. So we don't actually have any emails this week, Magellan, but...
Well, because we're recording early.
Correct. We're batch recording. So apologies. But do keep sending over the emails. We'll get to all of them as soon as, you know, the timeline catches up to us. I wanted to point out that I think we spoke last episode with Pat about Bester and how, whether or not the comic conflicted with what we saw in the episode where he talks about, like, my parents were killed when I was a kid. Yeah. It totally contradicts. I confirmed it. I pulled out my copy of The Psychorn You or whatever, and little Al Bester in that story has parents. They even have a plot point about, like, do I tell my parents that I'm experiencing telepathy or whatever? Like, I have these powers. Mm. We don't see them, but then, like, he has to get them to sign off on permission before he can go, and he, like, tries to go to the Psychorn. It's a whole thing. It's all recounted in, like, the last five pages of the comic, because the rest of it is just Psychorn propaganda. But, mm-hmm. Yes, he definitely references having parents in the comic, like, as a 10-year-old or whatever. So
I see. Okay. Well, then... You can read that however you want. Maybe his memory was altered, or he just chooses to say that
or
to make himself seem more likable.
Exactly. That's the read that I had. Or just the comics aren't canon. Some of them aren't. Yeah.
Right.
Fabulous. Well, we will be right back after this brief musical break to discuss And All My Dreams Torn Asunder.
Welcome back to Chatsalon 5. The second episode we watched this week was Season 5, Episode 16, And All My Dreams Torn Asunder. It was written by JMS, directed by GG, which stands for Goran Gajic. It aired JTN, which stands for June 10th, 1998, and it takes place from JT... I can't do it.
Thumpa Wump to Ongog Songo.
Yeah. It takes place from July 31st to August 6th of 2262. Alan, welcome back, my friend.
Thanks. I came back from the break time void, and I'm here to eat snacks and tell stories.
And you still have your snacks with you, too.
And I'm all out of snacks.
Yeah. And it seems like you brought a friend with you from the break time void.
I did. The great void known as Australia, Magellan. Now, folks, the thing about losing one eye is that it makes you look deeply into the eyes of another. I found in his all the things I will ever require in this life or in any other. Welcome, Ryan, from the Spin Polish podcast of the show.
Ahoy, hoy. How are you?
Good eye. I'm sorry. I have to do it every time. I can't not
g'day,
be a parody
g'day,
of an Australian.
Yeah. Good day. I'm excited. That's actually a big Australian quote, actually, from... a TV personality that's really, really dead by now called Big Kev, because he was big and he sold, I don't know, cleaning products. And his catchphrase was, I'm excited, in the most Aussie drone you could do.
Aww.
So, yes, it's a pleasure to be back talking B5 with you gentlemen.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you back.
And yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm excited. We're going to be talking good in season 5.
Shock. Yeah, You snuck yourself into the really, really juicy chunk of the season. As soon as I realized that this was going to be an episode where Londo just is stressed, I was like, yes, I have figured out what Ryan found in this, that they chose to be in it, or chose to guest on this one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, last time I chose because Londo was a good guy in a courtroom, and this time it's the whole episode is Londo being ridiculed in a courtroom. I mean, this is what my jam is. And also,
the parallels are all there. It's true.
And also, you know, Zach Allen, what a good boy. I love that guy.
Oh my God, I love Zachary Allen. I call him
Zachary. Please, he's from the future.
So we had been talking before we hit record about, you know, you're asking me like what we think about B5 now in hindsight and how much we're gonna miss it or not. Yeah, basically, I was telling you, like, I'm definitely going to miss the show in a big way because I have this good memory of it now. I have all of these, like, memorable moments. And I think it's one of the chat shows we've watched that has stuck with me more. Like, individual plot points have stuck with me a lot more.
Yeah.
It feels like the right time and right place to be watching it, like, for the age I'm at and where I am in life. It's like the themes of this show matter to me a lot right now. So I'm definitely going to, like, look extremely fondly back on it, you know?
Yeah,
definitely.
It's because like, it's a great show, but I always think like, oh, it's kind of just as with so many long chat shows, I'm like, oh, it starts out kind of dumb or kind of bad. But like, both of these episodes reference season one in ways that made me really fond and want to like almost rewatch some of season one. I was like, oh my God, yeah, they were like in the, like, Sinclair was here and everything was simpler back then and we didn't know how good we had it. Now we're just in misery town.
As I've said in the previous episode in emails, I like season one quite a lot. It's not, I guess, not a popular opinion, but I like season one quite a bit, so I'm a defender of that. And yeah, this final half of season five really calls back to the stuff that you had in season one. Like I said, we have the that diplomatic room where they used to go to actually discuss politics is back, and that was like a staple of season one and two.
Mm-hmm.
And now we got it back, and it's like the cruelest way it can come back.
Right.
You think back to season one and two, and Londo was like the king when he walked into that room. Like, he was like domineering and dominating and just so cruel and funny, and now it's just like the saddest thing.
Yeah, he's almost doing like kind of a like a parody or like a reunion tour of his season one persona, but you can feel that he like just doesn't
believe it
anymore. Yeah.
Oh boy.
He's in a rough spot. But to get into the episode, All My Dreams Torn Asunder, Goran Gajic actually notably husband of Mira Furlan, at least at the time.
They're still together, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, they are? Excellent.
I looked it up and they didn't say they were divorced, so who knows?
Fabulous. Yeah, I will say, I always try to, this is like the whole reason we note writers and directors and like credit where credit is due, but I felt a directorial touch on this episode that was like different than a lot of other ones. There's a lot of really great like hard cuts and cinematic choices just all over the place. Like they take that meeting room and they do so much with it that you just feel like you're in this space and you can feel the intense like anxiety and tension that everyone feels in that room just from how it's directed and how it's performed.
Yeah, it's simple stuff. They just do stuff that you don't see as much. Like in the courtroom, they put the camera like pretty much on the roof pointing down. You don't see that very often in B5.
Right.
So you're thrown off and you're like, oh, okay. Or like you said, editing, like just random cuts. Like you have a wide shot of Londo turning to point, and then it's like a hard cut to an intense close up of him pointing at Zach Allen. And it's like, whoa, that's really good, actually. Like you don't see that usually in B5. So yeah, the direction in this one is probably one of my favorites in terms of actual direction and visual and editing in B5. And this one doesn't even have like intense space battles. So it's just like courtroom drama, and the editing and the drama that is conveyed through visual language is really high up.
And everything on the periphery of that drama is also, it's what makes the, like, once they get into the room so strong. Even the Delenn and Sheridan stuff, which we'll have talked about and we'll talk about more, but this episode is bookended with the classic Babylon 5 narrative technique of Delenn lighting candles. Her candle is blown out at the end of the cold open, and then she relights it at the end of the episode. And that is basically how you know that shit's going to happen on a B5 episode, is like, oh, God, someone's lighting candles. Oh, dear.
Yeah, sometimes it used to be happy. Like, remember when Ivanova was lighting her candles?
Right, it can be a hopeful thing. It's more like, it's sort of like hoping that things will get better, you know?
Yeah, there is a lot of candles.
But then sometimes good things do happen, that's true.
Yeah. Well, but then there was the one time, yeah, where Jakar like lit all those candles for and everybody died or whatever.
Yeah.
Didn't that happen?
Jakar also had a bunch of candles in this episode when he was speaking to Delenn, so, you know, it's all right.
Oh my
God. I guess he just, yeah, always has candles, huh?
Yeah, he's a spiritual guy. He likes candles. Everyone.
That's true.
This is a universe in which candles and paperwork still exists. Be happy.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So as we open, though, we realize how dangerous it is to actually hold a meeting without Londo. And of course, this guy's mad. Everyone is like, yeah, we're going to the meeting. We're going to the meeting. All right, well, everyone's going. Here we go. Mm-hmm. And Veer and Londo are just like, wait, what? Are we not? We're going in, right? And Zach has to be the guy who's like, Londo, you know you're not allowed in here. And he's like, you cannot hold a meeting without one of the members. All that means, like, it's a bad idea because all that means is, yes, they're going to be talking about me. They're going to put me out of something or turn against me. So Londo is so rightfully riddled with frustration here.
This is probably my favorite scene of the episode, by the way. I love that interaction between not just Londo and Zach Allen, but Veer as well. Veer's there too. And I just love, Londo, you're used to him being like a blowhard. And usually when he kind of comes in with this gusto of like, I deserve this and you owe me this and blah, blah, blah. Usually you feel like he's speaking out of his ass. And you kind of just go, oh, Londo. But in this moment, you do feel for him and you do wish that he could get through and defend himself and stuff. And it's just not going to happen.
Right.
So it's a great scene. I love it. I just love the fact that in this show, all three characters, when we first met them, were silly fun characters. And now we're in the final season and they're like really serious and it still works. Like, remember season one Veer, where he was left playing little video game console thing, like his little Game Boy?
Uh-huh. And, oh my gosh, yeah.
Remember the early days where you guys didn't like Zach Allen too much because he was just like some guy who was just like goofy,
just generic cop.
Goofy. Well, yeah, we were still very much on Team Lou Welch at the time.
We all love Lou.
I'm still on Team Welch.
We all love Lou Welch, but I like...
You can't not.
You know, I like the fact that now we got Zach Allen here and he's being like this serious guy, you know, like he's having to face up to being the chief of security and having to actually be a main player in the story. And at the beginning he was just like some dude who was just like, you know, Sheridan, if I was Winston Churchill, I don't know if I could make that decision. And then the show's like, hey, what happens if we make Zach Allen make hard decisions? That's his character.
It turns out he's like, man, these are hard decisions.
And
the thing I think that makes Zach a better like security officer than Garibaldi in a lot of ways is he has that like personal touch when he talks to people about like, hey, you know me, like it's me, Zach Allen, and I'm here to talk to you like you're a person. I'm not here to talk to you like I'm just a cop. But he also knows where to draw that line and be like, Londo, you're not coming through the door or we're going to shoot you.
Yeah, well, I think what's charming about Zach is that he doesn't like having authority. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Like Garibaldi kind of
loved it.
Enjoys being a tough guy, but I don't really think that Zach Allen particularly relishes being the boss.
He just does it. Like it's just
He just knows that somebody has to do it.
It's his job. I think what makes this interaction here very tragic too is it's just you got like Londo storms off, he's like, fine, whatever, and then you just got Veer left there, as he always is. And usually in scenes like this, Veer would make a comedic statement or kind of just quickly follow Londo, but in this moment he's just like, how could it get any worse? And you kinda remember, oh yeah, Veer is a Centauri too. Like this affects him as well. As just Londo, like, oh yeah, Veer, poor Veer. This is this whole, his race getting screwed over. That's going to affect him too. And that's kind of upsetting because we all like Veer.
And he says, worse than what? And it's like, oh yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
He's acknowledging the awful state of things while also being like, you guys are not working to fix it. You're only going to make it worse. Mm. This is honestly like watching a slow motion train wreck this episode. It's so like I was engaged through every single second of it.
Yeah, the thing that struck me with that scene with Veer and Zach interacting is I had the thought of like, oh, damn, all of these people are friends with each other.
Yeah.
Every single high-ranking diplomat and security official and whatever, they're all like best buds.
Yeah.
And the part from the last episode where Delenn like just gives Londo a big hug.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, man.
They all, that's why That's why the season one comparisons are, they hit so hard, is you're like, there was a simpler time where we were worrying about like bad viruses on the ship, you know?
Yeah.
And now we're all pointing guns at each other.
Just to point out how much this episode relates to season one. In the courtroom, one of the alien ambassadors that's in the front row is that race that was into TKO, like in TKO, that was into the fighting. like that's how silly this show, that's how wonderfully silly this show can be. You have a serious courtroom scene, then you see an alien in the background, you're like, oh yeah, they were fighting about colors a few seasons ago.
Right.
And now they're like big players now. Like the Drazi are huge players in this. And you're like, oh god.
I can never forget the Color War stuff, because every time the Drazi are like, we deserve fairness, and I'm like, you guys fight over the color of your sashes. Same people, same Drazi, you know? But another really like fascinating scene is, and I actually had to pause for like 10 minutes to gif this one. I have the gif is on our Twitter at ChatsPod, but Franklin is describing to everyone how the eyes process the light spectrum and how different eye patterns can tell you which weapons are used on which aliens. This is so interesting to me as both like a techie nerd and also just like someone interested in crime and how these things are figured out. Because he concludes that the Centauri weapons are big and brash and they're all explosive.
Yeah.
And evidence of theirs was found everywhere because they don't leave light patterns. They just blow things up.
Well, they do leave some light patterns, but it's like, yeah, there's also explosive burns on the bodies as well as the color pattern matches. So it's like, yeah, the Centauri, you know, it's pretty much them.
I believe it's at this point, though, where Londo comes in and is like, hey, here's all this evidence you guys have. Here's all this stuff that tells you why you should kill me. Nobody ever asked me what I think about this. You guys are literally, you're about to start a war with my people without asking me, like, my side of the story. Well, none of this means anything.
Yeah, well, actually, before that, I think one of the great things that this episode does as well is you have each person enter Londo's room to give him evidence that they've gathered, and then you have Jakar come in to kind of give, like, he thinks Jakar's going to come in to give evidence because he, you know, had witnessed all this stuff and you're going to be a witness, but him and Jakar actually have, like, this great little dynamic to bring him into the thing. And it's just like, you guys were saying in one of your episodes previously, like, why didn't Jakar just tell the council everything that happened at Centauri Prime? And that kind of comes back in this conversation, you know. It's like, yeah, I saw this stuff, but it's like, it's not my place.
Yeah, Jakar brings it up
to do this, you know. This is your people, and you know, they're trying to have this tender moment here, but Londo's still Londo. He's like, don't tell me how I felt about this. And you just have like, Andreas Katsoulis just delivers this great line when he's just like, you know, he's been asked, like, why are you here? And he's just like, I came here to tell you. And you kind of hear like he wants to tell him something else. And then he's just like, that you're wanted to come to the meeting. Like, it's just like there's still that barrier between those two guys that is still there, even though they're pretty much best friends in the universe. They still have that barrier there.
And so then it is at this point that Londo brings all of that paper to the meeting room, to the room, and like says, like, none of this matters.
This is a joke.
Yeah, he throws it in the air, and I think I posted some of those, like, me on Fridays at 4:59 p.m. It's just like, it's such a beautifully like centered shot too, speaking of the cinematography.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, here's Londo, here's all the papers, and you can just watch, if you really pay attention, you can watch Jakar in the background like panicking, and he's like, no, come on, that's the only thing that is real in this courtroom right now, please don't.
And it's a gorgeous shot, because then you cut and you have him, and it's kind of slowed down, like a slow motion effect, or like they've slowed the frame rate of him turning to look at Sheridan, and the papers just all falling gracefully like behind him. And it's like, and then Sheridan just looking at him with like this stern look of like, fucking Londo kind of look. And it's just like such beautiful cinematography for what could have just been a simple scene of Londo being typical Londo.
It almost looked like a music video a little
bit. Yeah.
Like
we were about to bust into some sort of like R&B jam or something.
Yeah, it's like a Prince music video. Like here's the doves coming.
Yeah. The doves.
Right. All the papers turn into doves as they fall gently to the ground.
But it's true. None of it means anything. And then they're like, you know what does mean something? Is this literal footage from the previous episode that Lanier took?
Our good boy Lanier.
Our good sweet boy who's doing his damn best.
Oh yeah, he's a good boy. He's always good. Because that's a big plot point where it's like, oh well, if Lanier said it, then it must be true. because he's a good guy.
Yeah, no one has any reason not to trust Lanier except, I don't know, Sheridan probably, but that's he doesn't even know that he shouldn't trust everything Lanier says. Yeah. So he shows them that footage, and then you're just you spend the basically the rest, like I said, the rest of this episode watching Londo collapse. Because him and Veer go back to their quarters, and he's like, all we need is Homeworld to tell us things are okay. Like, you know, they're gonna see this footage, and it's gonna be totally fine. And we get this again, fantastic cinematography. He's called by one of the ministers, and the man calls it, quote, the most clever fraud he's ever seen.
Yeah.
And they take this opportunity to be like, actually, what most likely happened is that the Narn commandeered our ships and then used them and filmed it so that we would look like bad guys.
Yeah, or staged, or knew that Linnea would be inside and like coerced him to come to witness it. Because who's a better credibility source than a ranger?
It's all Linnea. Absurd.
This is where I put on my film class brain, because they filmed this conversation with like Londo, Veer. Londo and Veer are staring directly into camera. Like, we've seen probably tens, if not like 100 video conversations on Babylon 5 now. And usually the way it's filmed is like behind the back of the viewer, and you can see the screen that they're looking at to sort of highlight that, like, I am paying attention to you. But this is like, no, you don't need to see the minister because you already know he's lying. What you need to see is that Londo and Veer just want you to believe them. Like, just please tell me this isn't real.
Yeah, and also you don't even necessarily know for a fact that that specific minister is necessarily a liar or just carrying on the typical Centauri message that, you know, everything isn't our fault, because even Londo is using that old Centauri rhetoric of we never fire on civilians, blah blah blah, and then V is like, yeah, but what about everything we did to the Narn? And he's like, oh, but that was war, that's different, you know, that's completely other, we are not pirates. And it's just like, it's this, you know, this nationalistic rhetoric that goes through. So you can't even necessarily say that that minister could even be necessarily lying out of malicious. He could just be passing on the Parthi word without knowing himself.
It's hard to know if he's like in cahoots with the Drak or if he's just dumb. Like, if he's just a big dumb guy.
He is very smug. He is very smug.
I would have loved to see his character played by Patrick Warburton, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah. That guy?
That guy. Just imagine him as this Centauri minister.
I could see, if they did it today, that exact guy would be played by the guy who plays Littlefinger in Game of Thrones. Because they're both smug Irishmen, so it would work.
Yeah. The most clever fraud he's ever seen. I can't even do his type of accent
He has a lot more of a nasally. I mean,
you should hear him on The Wire. He's super different on The Wire.
Oh,
actually.
Yeah. Or he's, in.
But fantastic.
Oh, I can't remember. Queer as Folk, the British version. He was like the main guy as well. Littlefinger.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah.
So it's at this moment that. Oh, sorry. Did you have something you wanted to say, Ryan?
Oh, I was just saying, like, Majon was saying, like, or you guys were saying with the cinematography of, like, how we see the different angles now, like, you know, they're looking into camera. This, you know, this episode, yeah, it's got a lot of interesting direction, and all of it's pretty great. Like, you have moments like every time people come to Londo's room, you have Veer just in the background, and he's like, looks tiny and insignificant, and like, you know, it's like the way that they frame everything in this episode cinematically, like from a visual standpoint, is like really interesting and breaks the conventional things that you've seen in Babylon 5 without being breaking of the show's visual language in general as well. So yeah, you know, this episode visually cool.
Extremely, yeah. And like what I was saying earlier, it's not just like them wanting to believe whether or not that fact is true, but it's Londo and Veer being like, come on, like, this narrative can totally paint us as the bad guys. We are pleading to you, the viewer. We're trying to engender empathy in you, the viewer, to believe us. And you know it because you've watched what happened. Like, the great thing about, like, the way these stories work out in the TV format is it's this dramatic irony where, like, we know the truth of who ordered those attacks and why the minister doesn't want to talk to them and all that stuff, but... they still feel like, oh, people don't believe us. People just think we're bad people. Like, we're objectively bad guys in this story. So they're like begging you, the viewer, just like, please, like, give us a shot.
Yeah.
It's in this moment though that Londo makes, honestly, one of the most difficult decisions of his career, I would think, because so much of it has been like him striking at opportunity, and this is deliberate. Like, him choosing to leave the ISA is specifically like, this is, I'm going to make things worse, but I have to, like, I liked having that benefit, but you guys aren't going to give it to me anymore. And instead of having you strip me of my powers, I'm leaving.
Yeah, and Sheridan's like, you know, Londo, you can't just walk away from this one. Oh, how funny. I thought I was. Just like, he's already gone.
Weird, I am.
Too late, bro. And just leaves.
Yeah, he says, anyone who shoots on his ships is actually starting a war. It's kind of, it's pretty much the equivalent of like, you're fired. No, I'm not. I quit.
Yeah.
You can't fire me. I quit.
But
already.
It's also tragic because we know that this isn't Londo's choice. It's his government's choice, and he has to follow through on it. And then that means he has to leave Babylon 5 to find out what's actually going on. And he has to do that by going off Babylon 5 back to Centauri Prime. And as the episode states, you most likely won't come back here ever again if you do this. And he's just like, too late. I'm already going.
And it's the series, like, very mature realization that this is serious. Like, this is big time. Because when Franklin was like, I guess I'm leaving, it's like, that's a nice scene, but I know he's going to be in the rest of the show, and I'm not bothered by it. But this is, like, legitimately, Londo's probably not coming back to B5 unless they figure this out sooner than later. So the rest of the next couple scenes are him and other people, like, legitimately discussing what it's going to be like when he leaves. You have probably the most, for me at least, one of the most touching scenes in this episode. You have the Jakar and Delenn scene, which I want to talk about.
Yeah, go ahead, guys.
Jakar tells Delenn that he's actually leaving Babylon 5 with Londo because, you know, I promised him I would defend him, and I promised him I would go to Centauri Prime with him if he did, and I'm doing that.
And he's our only. He'll be our only hope to end this, basically, because he's the only good Centauri with power.
Exactly. He's the only person who knows. He's the only person with, like, the moral fiber to not just, like, let this war happen. He has the facts. And then just the it's the charming, like, niceness amongst tragedy and sadness that really sells all of this stuff between Katsulas and Furlan, because they're talking about, like, oh, I even booked the seat right next to Londo on the plane. And then Delenn's like, you know, he hates it when people talk to him on the plane. He's like, too bad.
You know, he's like, I know. He's like so giddy. Like,
I know, I'm doing it anyways.
He's planned this out. Like I know what I'm doing. This is gonna be fun for me. It's like,
yeah,
monster.
This one's for daddy.
One's for daddy lizard boy, yeah.
Exactly. And then she's like, you know, you're probably going to be like, you're the only Narn that's going to be on Centauri Prime, right? You're gonna be like one of the only Narn by yourself for a long time. Do you have anything you want to, like, tell me or give me? And the one thing he asks is, Delenn, can you please take the last chapters of my book? Because in those chapters, I relitigate everything I said when I was younger and stupider. And I need you to put that out there.
People are going to be saying some shit. They're going to be talking foul on my name.
Publish my manuscript.
I need to write my New Testament here.
Yeah.
Yeah. She says, Jakar, have I ever told you that you're one of the finest writers I've ever met? Which, I don't know why that line broke me.
It's because she's just such a good actress, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys remember, this scene, it calls back emotional beats for me of when her and Jakar talked about how she let his people get sacrificed for the greater good. And it's like that kind of dynamic where they're both very respectful and loving of one another, but there's a tenseness in between them. And in this scene, that intensity is no longer there. It's more like just pure understanding of one another as individuals at this point, like just pure respect.
Yeah.
And just, you know, Jakar, like, literally Jakar and any character he's saddled with have great dynamics. He's like the, you know, it's like you guys talked about how, like, Marcus was great because any character, like, when Marcus was good, he was because he was paired up with someone, and he always was good when he was paired up. Mm-hmm. That's Jakar as well.
Yeah. 100%. You can give Jakar any pairing in this series and it'll be brilliant and heart-wrenching.
Yeah, like King Arthur.
True. Yeah. Yeah.
Very
you're
true.
Right.
He's the best thing about that episode. It's true. And he drops that line. And season 5 has been a beautiful bounty. A roller coaster for certain, but also a beautiful bounty of, like, quotes for me to use at the start of the episode, because that thing about the losing one eye makes you look deep into the eyes of another. And in yours, Delenn, I found all the things I will ever require in this life or in any other. And it's like, oh my god.
Damn, buddy.
Everyone loves Delenn more than Sheridan loves Delenn.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Because we've had creepy guys being like, I can't wait to see you naked. And we've had nice people being like, I'm sure you are like, your smile, like the two guys, like the two engineers episodes.
Yeah.
Who are just like, oh, Delenn makes all my, like, looking at her makes all the problems go away. And you're like,
in Sheridan's defense, he's having to deal with terrorism, as he calls it in this episode. Not just
aggression.
Terrorism. Huh. And you're like, yeah. Oh.
What a weird, weak moment that was.
That was
so odd.
That specific line of when he just starts yelling about war.
That specific, I mean, the yelling was just not great, but that specific line. I don't want to transition away from Jakar and Delenn so abruptly, but something that I felt in that scene where Sheridan was yelling, like when he yells over the whole crowd and he's like, I said that's enough, is that when you watch a TV show, you can never really get the full effect of volume difference in someone yelling, because they can't just like crank the volume on you.
Bass boosted Sheridan.
Yeah. Like it all has to be kind of equalized, so it just sounds like normal talking volume, but somebody's mad.
I mean, in defense, they at least try by having the music cut out as soon as he does it. And
true,
that's true.
It's, you know, it's you can do what you can do. I didn't mind him yelling. I think Bruce is a good yeller, a good shouter, unlike Jerry Doyle.
Yeah.
So sorry, Jerry, but I think he can shout at least. I actually liked his shouting, but, I don't know. Do you want to,
again, that scene is bolstered immensely by the great direction, but, just a couple more really great emotional beats before we get to there. Cause that's like right about at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
This is another one where we're in Garibaldi's quarters, and every time his doorbell rings, I look at my phone every single time. It's when I watch this show, because it's my text tone, the doorbell, but when I watch The Good Place, every time Janet or her children like teleport somewhere, it's the Discord like disconnecting from voice noise, and I'm like, what? they use that noise, and I'm like, did they have to license that?
Probably.
Right.
It's this weird thing where you recognize sounds from shows, but Zach is here to talk to Garibaldi, and I have my problems with the portrayal of Garibaldi's alcoholism throughout the show, and especially last episode, but. This conversation with Zach is such a powerful, beautiful performance from two actors who clearly have dealt with people like this, and or have been people in this situation.
Yeah. I know Jeff Conway was a big addict, and apparently was at the time as well. So yeah.
And it's you can tell that they're past the point where, you know, they can be like, oh man, you're having problems, man. Like, that stinks. I hope you get that figured out. Like, let me know if you need help. And he's just like, no. He's just so tired of Garibaldi, right? He's just like, all right, you're not drinking, huh? And Garibaldi's like, no, of course I'm not. And he's like, all right, catch. And he throws him an orange and drops it. And he's like, all right, yeah, you weren't ready. That's fine. Here's another one. He drops it. And he's like, no reflexes. Interesting. Were you drinking, Garibaldi? And he's like, fuck you. And it's, I don't know, just every line from this felt like stuff ripped from the people I know who have dealt with like addiction problems, and from like trying to reject that it's a problem.
Yeah.
I thought the portrayal was pretty good. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think it can feel kind of like boilerplate at times, but there is something that just works about the fact that he sort of, even when Zach knows, like, okay, this guy's a drunk, I need to tell somebody, like, he should get in trouble. He needs to stop. Even though he knows all that, Garibaldi still manipulates him into being like, but just give me some time, buddy. And that feels really real and really sad for their relationship, especially because, again, like this thing that we talked about at the beginning about Zach and authority, he's really having to wrestle with, like, am I the authority figure? Am I the friend? And like, being the authority figure is how you be the good friend here.
Yeah.
So I don't know. At least Zach's side of it, I think, is really powerful. And then Garibaldi's side of it, yeah, it does kind of feel like, I don't know. There's not a lot of depth to it, but it also, I don't know that there needs to be more depth than what's here.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, more of that, more of the depth comes from Zach.
I think I think it's interesting too when you just talked about how Zach and authoritarianism and being authority figure and Garibaldi. You look at this scene and mirror it with Garibaldi talking to Franklin about addiction, and you see that they're two completely different approaches to the same typical same idea of the conversation where Garibaldi did flex a bit. He's the chief of security, and I'll have to go around you, and I have to do this, Franklin. But I'm also your friend. While, you know, Zach, he's hesitant to do that. He's, you know, he has that line where it's like, I'm doing this because I'm your friend, and, you know, we've been in the same place, and all of that. And, you know, you even though it's, I don't remember if it's explicitly stated what Zach Allen's past was. We always just hear that he had a rough past, but I don't remember if there's a point where we hear specifically what it was. But even if it isn't specifically stated, you can just feel that dynamic between them. Like, yeah, you said Garibaldi's a bit manipulative at times, and he is. Like, he does sometimes throughout the series flex over Zach that, hey, I gave you a break when you were down and out, kind of thing. But at the same time, they are friends. Like, they are genuine friends. So it's actually, it is heartbreaking. And then,
well, I think in the moment, Garibaldi wants to believe that he can handle it.
Mm.
I don't think that the sort of mind of the alcoholic is like, and now I will engineer this perfect lie. I think there's self-deception goes on too.
Definitely. I don't mean it like Garibaldi's doing it in a malicious way. It's just, you know, that kind of stuff.
Back against the wall.
And then, you know, Zach.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys felt about it, but when Zach just put his gun on the table.
The gun.
Yeah,
it's one line over, but I'm still like, I get it. I understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Garibaldi's like, a bit melodramatic, right? And he's just like, yeah. I don't know. I find that very powerful. But I feel so sorry for Zach Allen. He's just like, he's kind of the owned man in space as well. He's just so sad.
Yeah.
Truly, we are
what
all
I,
the
What I liked about the gun on the table moment was I was sort of expecting Garibaldi's like being mean to him, and I think we've seen characters like Franklin or something be like, well, fuck you. Like, I guess I'm not going to help you.
Mm.
But Zach putting the gun on the table really, more than anything else, showed me where he's coming from and how much he understands what's going on.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
And like how he understands, like, okay, this is not personal. He's hurling stuff at me because of how he's feeling about himself. Mm. So it's like, let's cut the bullshit here.
If you're going to abuse me, just do end it. Yeah. Like, just do this.
And and that's why it's so important that Zach found him instead. Like, we're really throughout the show seeing how different characters deal with Garibaldi's alcoholism. Like, when we saw Franklin deal with it, it was a whole different thing.
Mm.
When we saw Lise deal with it last episode, like, that was another approach that just didn't work, and Garibaldi manipulated and wormed his way out of it.
Right.
So yeah, Zach, he gets it, but he's still undone by the fact that he like wants to believe that his friend can just figure it out without getting in trouble.
Yeah.
It's one of the, testament again to Doyle's performances. You really do sense the weakness when he says like, Zach, I know what you did. Like, I know what you did before you got on here, because that is textbook like an addict manipulation tactic. And I don't mean to like put, again, we're not like trying to say like he's an evil tactician. Again, it's just him being like so afraid to be the bad guy in the scene. He's like, I don't want you to talk down to me. I want you to realize that I'm not the only bad guy here. You've messed up too. It can't just be me, because if it's only me, then I have to take responsibility for it. So actually, I think as somebody who even I've like tried to like help people with problems like this, I constantly run into that fear of like, are they just going to spit it back at me? Like, is that, because that's an argument ender reel usually.
Yeah.
And you can tell also that they've had this conversation before. And so the gun on the table is not, this isn't their first time getting mad about this. This is him being like, you're going to do this and you're going to get mad at me. Like, if you want to end it, just end it. Like, don't bullshit me anymore. That's what the gun on the table seems like to me.
Yeah.
It's a final straw kind of scene, which I think is what makes this so very, very good. I'm telling you, though, this is like just one of the more powerful episodes in general. Scene after scene of all of these great moments.
This is where season 5 begins, boys. like
6 episodes from the end.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah. This, you are on the home stretch from here. It's all amazing from here. Trust me. And yeah, it's upsetting that you had to wait this long, right, for it to get this great. Like, you know, you have your.
It felt like an instant, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah, partly because of our weird recording schedule, and partly because the stuff that was bad about the beginning of season 5 was actually interesting, whereas like the stuff that's bad about the earlier seasons was less interesting.
I mean,
so now that's good. It's just like, oh, we're in it. Okay, sure, bring it.
I often wonder what season 5 would have been like if it followed through. Now, has anyone told you what they planned for Ivanova in this season?
No.
If they did, I forget.
Oh boy. Byron was supposed to be her storyline, apparently. So just enjoy
that
image in your brain. So at least,
So
at least I can thankfully say, hey, there's one aspect positive about Ivanova not being in this season.
Yeah.
No, this episode, you know, this episode's very great because it keeps it to the, you know, the few characters. Like, it is just Londo and Garibaldi's story, both of their stories. And then, you, like you said, it's bookended with Sheridan and Delenn. But it's like, you know, these figures all just falling into absolute despair and collapse and, like, trying to do things and failing. And it's just, it's truly tragic. And you know that, oh, all these screw-ups in this particular scenario are going to lead to intergalactic war again. Like, even Garibaldi's alcoholism will help lead to galactic war.
Yeah, shit.
Isn't that terrifying?
We just can't have nice things.
Can't
have them.
No.
Since season 1. And that's why Zach originally comes to talk to him. He's like, Garibaldi, you're seriously drunk when you, like, have war at your fingertips right now? Like, you could help stop this if you just took a second, man. We could be fine. And then we get to watch all this tension come to what it seems like we agree is a bit of a messy delivery from Sheridan, where everyone's yelling in the courtroom and Zach's like, you know what? All right, everyone, back off. And they're all yelling and yelling.
Stop it. Quit it.
Stop.
Linnea's just like, get away from her, Drazi Ambassador, man. And he's just like, get out of my way, boy. Like, he's just like, get out of here, you little man. Like, the Drazi guy.
You small person.
The Drazi guy is great.
And Sheridan's like, guys, that's enough. Guys, I said that's enough.
I said that's enough!
He doesn't even... It's only two. He does a really quiet one, and then he does a scream, which was kind of dorky.
I think it would be
with
more
the petulant, like,
was,
handshake,
I think it would
too.
Be more dorky if it was three. Like, I think it would be more dorky if it was like, and that's enough. That's enough. That's enough! Like, it would be just too much.
And then
I think
just,
it should have just been the one, honestly.
Yeah.
Just the one loud one.
Yeah, why did you even say the quiet one? That's goofy. And he's basically like, this is all completely foobar. Like, this, you guys are bad. I'm bad for thinking you guys could work this out. You wanted a war.
Well, you got a war!
He basically gave you the season recap of every season of Babylon 5. He's like, we talked about peace. You don't want peace. Babylon 5.
Yeah, this is the trailer lines. Like, for the fifth season, you put this in the trailer to entice people, and then you cut it with some goofy scene as well, just to be like, oh, everything's fine. Like, it's like, you want a war? You got a war! Also, Penn and Teller is in this series.
Yeah, well, you cut it with, like, the part towards the end of this episode where Londo's like, he wouldn't dare imprison his own prime minister.
Cut to.
That was
amazing, though.
Yeah, it's all in this episode.
This
line would go into the opening sequence right after. There's a hole in your mind.
You want a war? You've got a war.
Yeah.
It's Boxley. I have it paused right now on his face right after he says it. He just looks like he took a fat poop. Boxleyner brings it.
Oh, he does deliver. Like, I don't think he's delivering it weakly. I just think it's just such a, you know, a scene. Like, this is a scene that's been written. Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
I mean, Babylon 5 can have many scenes that feel written. Like, Jakar, you know, he doesn't sound like a normal person, but it's because that's the character we've enveloped him so much, and Andreas Katsoulis knows how to deliver those lines that are so Shakespearean. Can I just say, in the Garibaldi scene, backpedal a bit, I love the fact that they clearly got the bowl of oranges from Sheridan's room to bring it into Garibaldi's room just so that we can necessitate this scene.
Throw them around.
Oh god, the infamous oranges.
Because, have you ever seen Garibaldi eat fruit? Don't think so.
Absolutely
he would be
not.
Eating that fondue thing that he needed all the ingredients for.
Yeah, why wasn't Zach Allen throwing paintings of Daffy Duck at him?
He just throws a hot bowl of Banya Cauda at him. It's like, catch this.
He just shoots him in the back like in season one that happened. He's like, catch this.
Ow, my spine, not again.
Give me that life training machine.
I think the other thing that makes that Sheridan's, it's like,
give me that immortality serum from that one episode.
It got destroyed, dang it.
Undestroy it, go back in time. Get me the third space teleport. We gotta go to the other world.
Oh,
just referencing obscure bullshit.
Take me to Gray 17, dang it.
Yeah, I got it. That's the only place I'll be okay.
It's missing.
I want my ashes spread there when I die. Yeah.
No, just the last thing to say about the Sheridan scene is, like, I agree, it's intentionally, like, Sheridan is snapped. He's a little bit petulant. He's a little bit just tired. I mean, he's clearly tired. He hasn't slept properly. You notice how many times this season Delenn has woken up in the middle of the night and Sheridan's like,
I was thinking the same thing. Like, towards the end of this one, he's like, Delenn, what's wrong?
I mean, don't you feel sorry for him? He has to sleep on an angle now, and now he's being kept up all the time. Like, poor Sheridan.
Right,
he's really putting in the effort to get sleep, and she's just like, I gotta light a candle, man. Candles are my thing.
And the other, like, directorial touch that I loved was when he's yelling, like I said, they're just cutting back and forth after, like, every line from two different angles.
Mm. Yeah, they're doing, like, jump cuts to either side of his face.
Yeah.
I guess just to really heighten, like, the this is, like, fraying at the edges.
Yeah, I thought that was cool, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure if you got footage from both camera reels, you could make 3D out of that, probably.
You can cross your eyes and do it.
Yeah, he's just looking right at you, screaming at you.
With that goatee right up in your face. Yeah.
You can actually, it's actually a, they're working on this. You can pay to have him say whatever you want.
Oh, good.
So,
right.
Now he'll it's say, like oh, you, we were talking about getting a salad. You don't want a salad.
I'd love that.
You want Wendy's? We're getting Wendy's.
I'd want that, but for Londo. Every
oh, for sure.
Your Londo voice app. That would be great.
Yeah.
Speaking of Londo, we get a slightly funnier scene, but this is, like, again, darkly comedic, where it starts with, once again, Londo and Jakar sleeping in the same room. This time, Jakar is sleeping at the end of Londo's bed horizontally.
Yeah, we've cleared up any ambiguity about what the sleeping arrangement looks like. It is the most adorable thing you have ever seen.
I mean, we had the bit before when they first arrived onto Centauri Prime, yeah, and the minister's just like, it isn't allowed to walk around here. It's like, he's not knit for a start.
Right.
It's like, oh, it must be a burden for you. And then Jakar's like, yes, it is, but, you know, I come to deal with it. Just being typical Jakar.
And you see the echo of that again here, where they go outside in the middle of the night and they talk to the minister, and they're like, yeah, we're putting Jakar under arrest. We'll put him in the... I can't believe they say we're going to put him in the nice prison until we figure out what to do with this. And what's so brilliant is not only that, it's once again the minister just being an absolute fuck, but Jakar, if you look really closely, gives Londo, like, this tiny little closed-lip smile when he's told that he's being put under arrest. Like, yep, I did expect that this was going to fucking happen. Uh-huh. Were you surprised,
I mean,
Londo? No, you weren't. Great.
I mean, how could you not be surprised when you walk onto Centauri Prime and there's just, like, thousands of warships flying in the air and you're the only Nan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That composite shot would have been another good cinematic moment if it didn't look terrible,
CGI-wise.
You know,
it's 90s. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's like they did a good shot, but it's just composited weird.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, you get the like, very sitcom-y cut of Londo being like, nobody would be so arrogant as to imprison his own prime minister.
Cut.
Might as well cut to, like, the noise of a prison door locking.
It did happen.
And then you hear a laugh track.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What a day.
It literally did. It was the exact sound mixing and cinematography of a comedy show. Where
yeah.
It's like close up to close up, zoom out. Uh oh, we're in the cell.
Do you find it great that in a show like this, in which one of the two characters in that scene is responsible for a space genocide, that you can still have a comedic scene like this?
Yeah, you gotta
for
love
sure.
It.
Like, and it feels real. It feels natural that you have this scene and you're like, yep. Oh, they're dynamic.
Uh-huh.
Just him being like, shut up, you. And he's like, I didn't say anything.
And then ends with a great maker. Sometimes I feel as if I don't understand anything anymore. And again, very like odd directorial choice. We zoom in on the moon above them, which then transitions to yet another candle as Delenn is lighting the final candle of the episode.
I think it's just a callback to when he was on Centauri Prime last time and he was like, I don't know what's happening up there with our ships, and it zooms out up to the moon.
To the Centauri ships, yeah, and they're like attacking each other. Yeah.
So I think it's just maybe a mirroring of that, because it's the same idea of I don't know anything and I'm the Prime Minister.
Yeah, right. And we get our final scene of the episode where Delenn laments the petty fights of men. She says life is precious and unique. We only get one shot at it. Why, we're always going to mess it up, though. I wish that we could stop messing it up. Let's hope for something better as we embrace for maybe the biggest war of our lives, except for the one where it was existence at hand.
Well, you know, it's different.
It's a different scale.
It's more personal now. They're not versing.
It's so much more personal.
Versing old gods. They're versing their friend.
Totally. Right. This feels so much more powerful and affecting than anything in the Shadow War, to be honest.
Although I do miss Mr. Morden every now and then. I miss that cheeky smile.
Oh, always. That cheeky bastard.
This certainly feels more like unnecessary, right? Like, that's how this war feels. When Sheridan's shouting about it and he's like, you have a war, I'm sure his feeling is, what? Like, this doesn't need to happen.
And it wouldn't have happened necessarily if Garibaldi wasn't drunk on his ass and didn't receive the message, which we didn't talk about either.
Right. And it wouldn't have happened maybe if Londo had said something about, like, hey, something weird's going on.
Yeah.
Like, this really is, there's no...
Or if Delenn was like, hey, remember the druck?
Yeah, right. There's no... Well, there is, like, a primeval evil, sort of. But, like, there's no primeval nemesis or god. There's no, like, malevolent dictator backed by a bunch of telepaths. There's just, like, some people who are mad that their ships got blown up.
Yeah.
And we're all a little cranky. And Sheridan's like, fucking, come on.
This really, again?
Well, I'm not the type to get too into, you know, modern warfare and whatnot, but it's kind of like, you know, like, yeah, you start out the show with your typical, like, black and white, this guy's good, this guy's bad, like, the shadows are literally spider people, of course they're evil, and then by this end of the series, terrorism has broken out from the Centauri, basically, you know, this pirate warfare, in which they're killing civilian targets and all this kind of crazy stuff, and now war is a lot more murky and gray and hard to define anymore, which is kind of neat. But it's unfortunate because it's our favorite boy, Londo.
Right. It's fascinating because on one hand, like, I think war starting on a miscommunication kind of a little bit misses the point of, like, how wars mostly start. Because, yes, on a basic level, all the flaws of man are, like, people not communicating properly. That's, like, what every story is about at its core. But, you know, the wars truly start for reasons. It's more stuff like what Sheridan's talking about, which is, like, none of us want this. Very few people except, like, military profiteers actually are like, yeah, we should, like, light up some conflict. It's more just like, if we don't start this, things are going to get worse in a different way. And so we have to use the resources at hand and prove that we can do this by making the first step.
Yeah.
And it sucks.
It does suck. I mean, I find it funny that in the earlier part of this season, you guys were talking about, like, oh, you know, all our characters are pretty much wrapped up except for maybe Garibaldi and Leda. And then you guys had a whole diatribe about, like, and Londo, he's redeemed, he's wrapped up. There's nothing that they can do with him to fuck him over any further. And I'm just like, ooh.
You're just cackling in the corner.
Yeah. Because I always think of season 5 as, oh yeah, the season where it's all about Londo, basically. It's like, yep, the Londo season, because everything else is kind of inferior. And it's just like, Londo, let's give him some more stuff. Like, when you're in the Byron days, and then you have a whole episode of Londo having a heart attack, and you're like, oh, yeah, this is great. But, yeah.
I wanted to talk about the sort of implications of this final part from Delenn, because Babylon 5 is so concerned with religion. And one of the cool things that she talks about is, like, because she's comparing humans and they're just people to candles. And we all get a light. We all get the single one. It's very easy to snuff out. It's also easy to spread its ideas. And... well, in our time on Earth, we convince ourselves that our light is somehow better than other people's. But we're wrong. We know it's not. And there's a part of us that knows it's not. And the best people in us can hear that voice and work with it. And the worst of us ignore that voice. There is a spirituality there that I think is really important. And it's important not only for like understanding Minbari religion and where Delenn's coming from, but like where I hope that Sheridan and Delenn are going to tackle this conflict. It's like none of us matter. Like none of us, yes, you know, conflict is bad and we want to stop it, but the way we stop that is accepting that nobody, there shouldn't be a winner here. People need to learn to say sorry, basically.
Because we
don't get a second chance at this, like, you know. And then Delenn acknowledges, like, yep, a lot of candles gonna go out tonight, guys.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing that strikes me about that scene is when she talks about how we're all just, when you paraphrase it, it sounds dumb, but it's like, we're all just molecules, man. Molecules don't know politics. I mean,
she literally did the Carl Sagan, like, we're all space dust in a previous season two. So, like, right. She said that. She's done that kind of thing, but yeah.
You can see on Sheridan's face that he is just reeling inside about all of this is totally pointless.
Yeah.
Everything that's happening is so pointless, and I'm tasked with defending an alliance that is itself like a kind of a shell or a ghost or a joke of an alliance. Like, nobody wants to be a part of it, but like I have to defend it because I have to, I guess.
Yeah.
And now I'm gonna send people to die because I think that this is important,
because I made a promise,
but it's barely existed and it's already falling apart. Like, he's just like, ugh.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that is interesting stuff, like, for Sheridan when you describe it that way. But you guys, in your previous episodes, I haven't heard the latest one coming up, haven't been too wrapped, it seems, with that kind of aspect of Sheridan's storyline of things. Because it's been kind of like, for me, I think the problem is it's weird because it feels like it's in the background, yet it also feels very prominent in the show.
Yeah.
Because you're distracted totally. By, oh, it's Byron time now, a character that we've never met before. Or, hey, let's have an episode all about Mr. Bester. And you're like, okay, right. I mean, I like that episode, but like, okay. You're like, why can't we focus on our main lot of characters more so? Like, I sent you an email being like, why can't we have Leader actually be more important to the plot than just in the background? And it's just like weird choices in season five. Even like in this episode, I like this episode, but it's like, you know, yeah, I don't know. I don't care for Sheridan at all in season five. If anything, I just forget anything. And so when you guys describe these intricate things, I'm just like, yeah, I guess. Like, it sounds neat.
I guess he's doing that.
I guess it sounds neat right, when you guys describe it in your podcast. But it's like, when you actually watch it, it's kind of like barely existent.
Yeah, you have to read into it really far, because we just, it's so sparing the Sheridan interiority that we get in this season. And it's like when, I don't know, when the two leaders of the whole shit are married, wouldn't you think that you'd like get to see them talk to each other? And we like never see them talk to each other in this season, or rarely do. We did in the previous episode.
Yeah.
When they talk about Lanier and stuff. But like,
it's,
you know, you... finally, we're getting a scene like this candle scene where they're just sitting together and processing what's going on. And you want more of that, because otherwise we've sort of put these characters in this position of power and we don't really have any understanding of what it's like.
Yeah, but that's the unfortunate side effect, I guess, of having had wrapped up your show technically a season beforehand.
Right.
And then you're like, I guess I should focus on these other characters. And also, we've got a new character with Tracy Scoggins, who really isn't in the show. I was like, oh yeah, she's not in this episode, huh? Oh yeah.
Oh my god.
Remember how she's in the show?
I totally forgot.
She's in the show,
that.
Guys. Yeah. Don't worry. Yeah. She'll come back around in the movies.
Thank goodness. Boy. Well, to speak to a couple things, I think I appreciate the comment about, like, you guys are finding things that you didn't even think were interesting when you were watching. And that's both the blessing and the curse of the format of our show is like I try to find something interesting about almost every scene in the show, like something worth mentioning or something worth like finding a joke or finding a comment. And like I'm over here scrubbing through the last 5 minutes of this episode right now looking for like anything, because I'm like, Sheridan, just like you said, is not the focus of this season. And you know, when you're presented with like a bonus season despite thinking you didn't have one, yeah, you're gonna spend that time focusing on side characters because Sheridan got 3 seasons to be the main character. And it's like, no, you're not the guy anymore. But then every once in a while they're like, yeah, but you still are, as a leader, you're important, you're the president. Yeah. You know, and so you have this final shot that I've been like poring over, trying to like figure out what to read into it, where Delenn leans onto his shoulder and they both look out into the sunset.
Yeah,
because it's this moment of acknowledgement that like we are about to watch a lot of people die, and we're gonna like order a lot of people to die, which is something that they've definitely felt before. But also like, hey, Delenn, you haven't like been this intimate with me in a while.
Yeah,
like this very like, yeah. Oh, like I was almost like struck back by like, oh my god, they haven't like had a cuddle moment or like a tender moment in this fashion since like last season, at the end of last season.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember you guys in the early days of their relationship were just getting annoyed at the fact that they haven't gotten together, and then now we're at that point where it's like, oh, they got together now and it's boring. Like, it's that unfortunate thing of they're not doing anything now that yeah. they're actually together. But at the right. same time, you don't want them to cause manufactured drama like, oh, Tracy Scoggins is my ex-wife, because that's incredibly dumb and boring and trite.
That's not good drama.
But then you want the show, you just go, hey, Babylon, could you just be, Babylon 5, could you just be the Londo show? And they're like, we can't because he's too weird of a character to make just the central character. You can't just put Londo as the center character in the final season, yet they should.
It's my last comment, though, is it's a TV writing thing, right? Where you can't just have, unfortunately, maybe I don't understand enough about how TV shows are made. You can't just have a married couple be fine. Like, there has to be like some conflict, but they're not going to have like Delenn cheat on Sheridan or anything like that. They're not going to have any of the traditional things that like come as a wrench in a marriage. It's just like, no, they're fine, but the world is falling apart. And so it gives us this dissonance of like, this doesn't feel real. Mm.
But what I'm even asking for, they don't seem fine. They seem like totally distant. And I think what I'm wishing season 5 gave us is, some kind of like insight into their relationship, that like they're very different people and they would have very different philosophies about like how to maintain peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that's something that the show is missing out on exploring, because since the very beginning, since season 1, Babylon 5 has been a show about like, what is peace and like, how do you have it? And it seems like we can't actually have it, or like just peace for peace's sake isn't something to aspire to, or we have to understand what peace even looks like or what it's for. And season 5 is the season where we can really kind of directly grapple with and answer those things. And it's just not happening, because we're not spending time with Delenn and Sheridan, who are the two characters who are best positioned to like think about it. I mean, I think we're getting Jakar and Londo give us some things to think about, with Jakar's sort of like I don't know, post-racial utopia or whatever his idea of a great life is, and Londo trying to be a reformed imperialist who still is kind of an imperialist.
Yeah.
But like, Delenn and Sheridan are literally running the United Nations. Mm. And it's, I don't know. I would have been interested to see sort of like, when they're lying in bed, how do they talk about like strategy?
Yeah.
Because they kind of talk about that a little bit in, again, the episode we just watched, with like, should Lanier have been stationed here? Yes or no. But that had a element of like, well, this is a cheesy thing because it's like her secret boyfriend, you know?
I think also a big problem is with season 5 and Sheridan and Delenn. Unfortunately for me, and I've watched this show I don't know how many times, I still don't fully register or understand what the full-on goal of the Interstellar Alliance really is, because it's so vaguely put together, and it's very like, here, we're going to just do this, because I guess, yeah, like, once you make our lead character overthrow Earth, you might as well make him president of the galaxy. And like, I still don't understand, like, when we first start off in Babylon 5, we understand the mission statement of B5 as a station and how each character fits into that. But in this Interstellar Alliance, I never fully grapple the whole picture of how they work as an institution. So, like, that's a big problem, because then you're like, oh, well, this is Sheridan's storyline, and if I don't understand it and I don't like it, then I'm not going to really grapple, focus on it and like it as much as, say, clear understanding of spooky shit's going on in Centauri Prime, because, you know, Londo is a sad man. You know, like, like, that's it. But, yeah, you know, that's an unfortunate side effect of that happening. But then, like we said, this episode's a particularly great one, because we're getting back to that political thrilling drama that is Babylon 5, that is Londo Mollari and Jakar and all these players having to basically break apart from one another.
I mean, it's the title of the episode. You're watching a bunch of people's dreams be torn asunder. Like, you're just watching, you're watching the Alliance fail, you know? I always come back to deconstruction and people being like, yeah, they tried that. Didn't work very well. And you're like, yeah, here's why. It's because a bunch of people were ignorant and didn't ask the right questions at the right time and had to follow through on those promises.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious now where we wrap up, and if there is a, like, ultimate purpose of the Alliance. It sounds like there really isn't, but just I'm just curious, like, where this is going. I'm like fully on board with the season now.
Yeah. Yeah, now it's getting good. It's cooking.
Mm-hmm. It's cooking with full gas. Magellan, can you do me a quick favor, my friend?
Sure thing, my friend.
Can you tell me what we are watching next week on Chatsalon 5?
All righty. Next week, we're watching two more episodes of Babylon 5 Season 5.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
First, we're watching Episode 17, Movements of Fire and Shadow. The seemingly purposeless Centauri attacks culminate in a bizarre and terrifying climax. And then we're watching episode 18, The Fall of Centauri Prime. Londo discovers that the Drox are really behind the war, planning to alienate the Centauri from the Alliance.
Mm-hmm. Not a fun time.
Two things. One, they say Centauris in there, which makes me really angry. And two, Ryan, I believe you did actually send an email that was like, hey, guys, don't read the episode description anymore.
They're a little bit too information-y for what I would say. But yeah, like, once you read a title called The Fall of Centauri Prime, you could just end the description there.
Yeah, it's like, okay,
I
gotcha.
Was about to.
Yeah. We actually, we're cooking with guests now, and we're going to have a guest on for that episode, actually.
Very exciting.
For the Fall Centauri Prime, if all works out. So, yep, I'm excited to keep cranking along. But before we get there, I want to take it to the plug zone, if that's okay with both of you.
Let's do it.
Thank you. If you would like to contact the show, send us emails, comments, feedback, send those over to chatspod@gmail.com. That's chatspod@gmail.com. Check out @chatspod on Twitter, where I'm regularly posting jokes and comments about the episode. And if you have any questions, you can send them there as well. If you are more of the talkative type and you aren't able to schedule a guest appearance, feel free to send us voicemail comments. Keep them as MP3 files and under 2 minutes if possible, and just email those right over to us however you get them. We'd love to play some voicemails if people want to put their words into sounds. Also consider rating us on iTunes. That's how people hear about the show. And finally, if you would like to support us financially, do consider checking out patreon.com/chatspod, where we're putting out bonus content pretty much every week at this point. We're in full gear.
Metal Gear.
This season with bonus content.
Metal Gear Solid.
We're in full Metal Gear. We have different tiers at $1, $3, and $5 a month. So at $5 a month, you get all of our shows. You get pilot chats every other week, where we watch a TV pilot recommended often by the listeners, sometimes by Ryan. we did Duckman, actually, as part of your recommendation, and we have a lot more in a big old list right now. So we watch a pilot, we talk about it.
Which I suggested a while back.
We did, yeah.
I was curious of how you would feel about JMS in a different era of television.
The dude still doesn't put a lot of people in color in his shows. I'm just kidding. No.
I mean, this, this show, oh boy, Babylon 5, you know, only one person of color spoke to another person of color. That's it. No other ones. Like Franklin's dad, he wasn't.
No
he
other
wasn't
ones
in the show.
Ever.
Oh my gosh. I don't like that this has become a bit.
No,
baby daddy like it.
We're going to cancel our own bit before we get canceled. We have nights where we just actually put out a really great nights episode last week, which people should listen to, talking about the Nick Hotel, amongst many other things. And then once a month, if you do just a dollar a month, you can get commentary chats, and that's where we watch movies that are also recommended by people. So, yeah, check out the bonus content.
It's fun.
And while we still have you here, I want to say thank you again to Ryan from Spit and Polish Presents for being with us.
Thank you.
You're always a pleasure. And Ryan, do you have a chatsome for this week for the kids?
For the children out there. Yeah, I finished
Gather around.
Gather
everybody.
Around, children. I recently finished rereading Catch 22. I
Hell
recommend
yeah.
reading it. I read it again because the new miniseries came out. And I would recommend not watching the miniseries because it sucks, unfortunately. Unfortunately, it's one of those shows that focuses on the wrong aspects of the stories. Like, you go, oh, okay, for an anti-war show, you're focusing on the fact that he's a bomber pilot a lot. Like, 70% of that show is him dropping bombs, which is weird, because that's, like, 2% of the book. So you just go, oh, okay, but I recommend reading Catch-22. It's a fun time. For the most part, it can be pretty tragic, but it's a well-written book. I love the characters. It's one of my favorites. One of those few books that in high school they're like, hey, read a book and write about it that I actually enjoy.
Yeah.
And actually I'm glad that it was actually on the curriculum at all, unlike other books that they made me read. I would recommend giving it a read over, or even if you're not a big reader, maybe even watch the original movie. The movie's pretty good, actually. That's star-studded. It's got everyone in it. It's got a young, sexy Alan Arkin, if that turns you on. So, yeah, that's my big chat. So I've just been delving into the Catch-22 world and just loving it. It's very, very funny and miserable at the same time.
Fabulous. Magellan, my dear friend, do you have a chat?
Yes, sir.
Week?
I have a double chatsum. Is that okay, buddy?
Double dose me, baby.
Double dosing. I have two albums that I'd love to recommend to people by groups that I don't know if I've chatsumed in some way or another before, but perhaps I have. The first is an album by Electric Guest.
Oh.
By the way, one of the guys in Electric Guest is a brother of one of the guys in The Lonely Island, and their music is very different.
Really?
But Electric Guest is sort of fun. Alan, how would you describe it? Kind of like, it's like pop, electric-y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dream poppy, but yeah, electric pop, electro pop is how I would describe it.
Yeah. They put out an album called Kin. About a week ago, so I would strongly recommend listening to all of Kin. The single Dollar is the first song on there, and that's a really, really fun one. And then my current favorite artist, Rex Orange County, he put out an album, I think, the 25th, which is the day before we're recording this. He put out an album called Pony. And it's lovely, and you should check it out. I love pretty much everything that guy does, so that's what I recommend.
Yeah. For Electric Guest, I feel like you recommended me them way back in the day with their last, with like 2013, and I was like, yeah, they're kind of cool. I get it, and you know, Asa Tacon, that's cute. And then Kin, I listened to a lot on the way to and during our last trip, hangout together in New York. So it's kind of like. I've come to associate it with that trip, but I love everything on Kin, especially Dollar, and especially More, which is one of my favorite pop songs of this year, honestly.
I like 24/7. That's my favorite.
24/7 is very catchy, yes. And then Rex Orange County, yeah. If you want to just like be sad, I'm a big fan of like sad boy pop music or sad boy, whatever this type of music is, where they like enunciate really well.
That's so, okay. Yeah, so my... roommate and I kind of like go back and forth of like, okay, well, you like songs that have this in it, whatever. And it's helped me crystallize what I like in music. And Rex Orange County checks every single box because it's like very clear to understand lyrics that I can sing along to. It is upbeat, sad. There are quasi rap breaks. There are surprise horns. It's like, you know, smooth and clear. And it's just, it's just great.
He's got, he's got a beautiful diction, if that's, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, his lyrics are just so, oh, in your feelings all the way.
Yeah. Alan, what about you? What's your
I surprised Chatsum. I had like a bunch of different ideas for Chatsums. And then I was like, I watched this film last night and I don't know why more people haven't talked about it. I watched the 1980s movie, the Jim Henson Company's Dark Crystal, which I know people talk about, but every time I read, I like tried to read about the original series, everyone just says, it's really dark for a kid's movie. It's such a dark kid's movie. Like, why is this a kid's movie? And as soon as you just take 1 second and are like, it's a movie that like Jim Henson wrote like in a hotel room when he was like freezing because of the cold, and just like wrote a 50-page manuscript and they condensed it into a film, it makes a lot more sense why it's that kind of weird. He based it on a lot of like interesting New Age philosophy that he had been studying before that in the like 70s and 80s. And you know, if people have seen Labyrinth, it's the same vibe of like, it's all puppets, really like beautiful, meticulous sets, and very intricate puppet and like animatronic work. It's Henson and Oz and their company, and Dark Crystal in particular, like, I think actually I enjoyed more than Labyrinth, just because...
One has David Bowie.
It's so true.
But one,
like,
but one
Labyrinth
does
is
have
fun.
As a noise said a lot.
Oh my god. I now the person I watch that with, every time I do that, they like, no, we have like, that's our moment. It's like, yep, we're joking about the same thing because it's too funny. And also Simon Pegg plays that character in the prequel, which I'll also mention, is really
Netflix
good
series.
Yeah, so the Dark Crystal, the original movie, is just like really heady and weird, and it feels like they wrote something really huge and condensed the frick out of it to make it into a 90 minute film. And then they got this prequel show that they got on Netflix. It's 10 episodes. This was what inspired me to watch the movie, was because I saw a tweet from someone that said, and this is for all the Chats listeners who are still listening to this part of the episode, they reused sets from Farscape for this show, y'all.
Yeah.
They literally put covering on him. They totally, it's honestly the like easy elevator pitch for the show is like, what if Game of Thrones but with puppets? Like, it's got factions, it's got family drama, it's got all that. But the movie is like very straightforward and like thoughtful, and the symbolism is really good, and it's like deeply sad as well. It's about the end of the world and people like trying to prevent the last minutes of existence. But it's also these like cute puppets.
Some of them are so
and like
cute.
Bird people.
The Skeksis. The Skeksis.
For sure. Some of them are
not cute. They're sexy. No.
The sexy Skeksis. Oh my god, the one that gets naked. The
Chamberlain.
That one.
Yeah.
Oh, I love them. Chamberlain's fantastic. Yeah. But the little bit I've watched of the show Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance, also fantastic. They more puppets, please. 2019. That we're bringing back puppets.
Oh yeah, puppet revolution.
It's true.
How good would Avengers have been,
folks,
if
that's...
Thanos was a puppet?
If just Thanos was a puppet,
he's,
everyone
he's a
else
CGI
was
character.
Not.
Like, because he's a CGI character,
right.
So him as a puppet.
Oh my god, if he was a big puppet.
like Big Bird?
Oh, that'd be so stupid.
Just watching, I'm just imagining, like, imagine like a Cookie Monster and someone's like, what did you give up? And he turns to the left and goes, everything. You're like, the puppet doing that.
Oh god, that would be amazing. It would be amazing.
Please give me that
Frank
edit. I bet you, yes. Yep. Someone, maybe like when they filmed it, that's what they had to do. It's like, we're gonna replace this with CG, it's gonna be Josh Brolin, it's gonna be sick, but for you guys filming, it's just a puppet.
Oh no, they had Josh Brolin there, but he had a Thanos bust on top of his head, so they had to look at that.
Oh my
god, yeah, imagine that.
Is that how they did it?
Because Josh Brolin's too good to waste to just do voiceover.
Right, you're not gonna just get him for mocap.
Yeah, you're gonna get him for everything. But Dark Crystal, yeah, I haven't watched that since I was a kid. It just was one of those.
It's worth watching as an adult when you can actually understand the themes and not just be like, whoa, he hit the crystal with a sword
right.
really hard.
How smart I was as a kid. All right.
When you were a big dumb idiot. No.
My boy's Zathras. Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Right. Well, thank you again to Ryan for joining us on this episode of Chat.
Yeah, pleasure. Hopefully people and can check out my podcast as well. Nick did. Nick gave me... You guys were on. I should mention that. You guys were on the show, on my show.
We were on Spin Polish Presents a little while back, talking about it Falling Down.
It was a heated episode. Yeah. We talked. Alan started with the... Not to say that this movie was terrible, but... And I'm like... This movie sucks. Right, no. It was a fun time. We've got to get you guys to come back on at some point.
Yeah, we'd love that.
Certainly.
I don't know what...
We're a package deal.
Oh, okay. I mean, I guess. I'll take both of you. No. But yeah, it was a pleasure. So if your Chats people haven't had a chance to head on over to listen to your episode, at least, you should give it a go. Nick listened to it, and he gave me some opinions on Falling Down, which was like, I'm just happy that people are watching that movie. So there you go. Thanks guys for coming on for that, and thanks for having me come on again for this. It's so weird because it's part of me is like, this will be the last time I'll come on for a Babylon 5 discussion. Because it's ending, guys. You're going to cry? How quick is it going to make... How quickly are you going to come back and revisit it?
I don't know.
I want to watch a little bit of season one as soon as I finish, just to like... I always like to do that when I finish long shows, like watch the beginning again. But... A rewatch will have to be a little while, just because we have a lot of shows in the tank, you know. But I mean, you can always be. We have 13 episodes of Crusade. We only have one claim so far, so you have 12 choices.
Maybe we'll see it again in 100 years.
In 100 years,
we will come back to it in a million years when we have become. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh man, I can't wait to become. Honestly. Well,
yeah, that's gonna be dope.
Also, thank you, Magellan. I gotta say, my co-pilot, my hero, my savior, my love of my life.
Oh, Habibi.
And also, thank you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Chats Lawn 5. Peace.